Welcome to Witch Lit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witch Lit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. All our titles can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. If you'd like to support Witch Lit, please consider buying us a coffee at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. An apothecarist and wart cutter, Camden S. Cornell has an avid love for plants of all kinds. As a bioregional animist and folk witch, they specialize in using the plants around them for their herbal and magical craft. As a non-binary gay queer, the outsider perspective is important to them, and they are deeply drawn to invasive species, which have been much maligned and persecuted. That working relationship spurred the creation of The Tameless Path, unleashing the power of invasive plants in witchcraft. Camden also teaches classes on foraging, survival, and field herbalism in the Sandia Mountains east of Albuquerque, New Mexico, as well as classes on tarot, alchemy, and witchcraft practices. They own a small witchcraft-based business called Heart and Vine Apothecary that focuses on herbal remedies and ritual goods. They are the author of two self-published works, Ars Granorum, The Six Seed Arts of Witchcraft, and On Needles and Pins, A Witch's Book of Puppetry and Finger Magic. They are also a regular columnist for Numenia News, the periodical publication released by the Covenant of Hecate. Camden Cornell, welcome to Witchlit.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So our first question for everybody on the show, and I am so excited to talk to you about lots of things in addition to writing, but our first question for everybody is, you know, in this age of visual media and short attention spans, why still write? Why still write books?
Oh, why still write books? I mean, I grew up with books. I have always loved them. I've always wanted to write. But in a world where media is changing so rapidly and in such a profound way, there's just something about books. Like, a book is, it's like a doorway into someone else's mind, and you get to take much longer with a book, and like really spell things out and lay out a lot of different philosophies. And I think also, like, something that we may be missing more and more is the fact that a book like engages so many other parts of the mind, mm-hmm. than just watching media or digesting media that's made to be like very short and like pre-digested in a way. A book is stimulating like not only the language centers of the brain, but also like the visual centers of the brain, because mm-hmm. you have to be like visualizing things as you're reading, or like even in the case of people with aphantasia, like you're still imaging those things, right? Like mm-hmm. you're building a mental network around it. And reading a book gives you the time and the opportunity to really engage with the information and build like a whole neural network around the information that you are partaking of. And I think that that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Plus, like, we were just talking about footnotes, and like a little TikTok video, you can't put like hundreds of footnotes in.
Yeah.
And I want you to know like where I got the information from, and be able to share like interesting side thoughts and like have a deeper engaging conversation, even though I may not be right in front of you.
I agree on all that, especially like in writing fiction. I always think, and I will have to footnote this in the show notes, that your brain can't really distinguish between something that's happened to you or something you've read. Like, you have that experience, like you are actually living it when you're reading fiction. And I think with nonfiction, it's you know, to me, it's kind of like being in a lecture hall with like just someone who has your personal, you have their personal attention for the duration. So.
Yeah, totally agreed. And like every author puts so much of themselves into a book. Like it's not just like a little snippet of information or like a little fun thing. It's years of research. It's years of dedication. And not to say that that's not possible with social media posts and stuff, because it absolutely is. But I don't know. There's just something weighty and deep about a book. Like you're at the edge of the known and the unknown. And like you're going on an adventure, even if it is a nonfiction book. Like you're in it for the adventure.
Exactly. Well, and I feel like it's funny. Camden and I were talking about this before too. We started recording that, you know, there's a lot of kind of 101 witchcraft books on the market. And because that's how a lot of people come to witchcraft, is through a book. Like each book is a door for someone maybe to walk into this world. And, but even in reading those, even though in many cases it feels like they're covering the same territory, you're still getting that person's perspective, and it's always a little different.
Yeah. Which I think is cool. Also, like in a more magical sense, like if you think about a book, like as a magical object, if we're thinking about grimoires and books of that nature, like they're really tomes of collections of symbols, right? Mm-hmm. And like each word that you're creating is kind of a symbol that's evoking a particular feeling or a particular thought. And then you're weaving those into these larger workings, which would be like your chapters and stuff. And like you're actually engaging with someone in a magical way through a book. And books really are these magical interfaces that I think there's just nothing like a book.
Yeah.
There really isn't.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you said that about magical symbols, because one of the things that's been rolling around in my brain a lot lately is, you know, as a witches and occultists, we tend to lean toward these, you know, like Theban or Enochian, or, you know, depending on your bent as a practitioner and how you feel about things, Hebrew, you know, these written alphabets that have more symbolic meaning. And we kind of lose the fact that the alphabet that we use also has that, because we're so familiar with it that it's lost its magic in some ways, but it's still there.
So. Yeah. No, totally. And engaging with it in that way, I think, is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Read a book.
Read a book. This is our 10-second or 10-minute ad for go read a book. So speaking of books, you published two books yourself before you published Tameless Path with Cross Cross. I just kind of wanted to talk about your, I guess, journey to publishing your work and what that was like for you.
Yeah, with the self-published stuff. So the first book I wrote was Ars Grinorum, The Six Seed Arts of Witchcraft. And that's really like personal reflections on witchcraft and like how I was developing at the time, and like a lot of thoughts that I had distilled down into like these six categories that one could focus in. My brain does not want to bring them all up right now, but it was like veneration, hedgecraft, spellcraft, which I called thaumaturgy. And it was an interesting exploration for myself that I wanted to share with people because I thought it was cool. And then the self-publishing aspect of that was all right. My mother had actually self-published a children's book called Thistleton and the Magic Sea Bubble. Super, super cute. But she had just bought like a bunch of ISBNs. Mm-hmm. And so she was like, oh, you want to publish that? Here's an ISBN. And so she just tossed me one, which was really great.
Yeah, that's expensive.
And then she like helped me go through like getting the Library of Congress stuff in order and registering the book. my grandfather had actually helped her print her book. He was a graphic artist and like an old style printer, but he had passed away. And so I just wound up printing it through Barnes & Noble printer and getting a bunch and then marketing it and selling it on my website. I've actually sold quite a few that way, like in the hundreds, not like the 1 million copies sold. But
hey,
like,
I mean, you know, based on, you know, what discovery that came out for one of the giant merger lawsuits, they're like half the books published don't even sell 100 copies. So
yeah,
you're ahead of the game. You're ahead of the game.
We're ahead of the game. I sold a few hundred, I think, maybe up in the 400s, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And then On Needles and Pins, that was an interesting one because I was just talking to my friend about puppets and like figure magic. And then she was like, oh, you should write a book about this. I was like, you know what? I should. And so I did. And I shipped that one to a couple of like larger publishers, but it a lot like we were just talking about, a lot of the older publishers don't like printing you know, certain things. Like works on Maleficium are not always the most accepted. And this one, like On Needles and Pins, works a lot with Beneficium and healing and like using puppets in that way, but also like, you know, they have been often used for malefic purpose. Right. And so there is a lot of that in that book as well. And so it was a little glitchy getting it out there. So I self-published after running a Kickstarter, and a lot of people on Kickstarter were super interested in it. Mm-hmm. And then everyone that bought a book, like you could decide what other little goodies you wanted. And then everybody got a little puppet box, and like with the book, they got stuff to make puppets and like magic pins and stuff. And a friend of mine, Wea Hedera, still uses her pin in her videos, her love pin, which I love seeing. It's so cute. Yeah. Every time it pops out, I'm like, oh my gosh, we're friends.
Yeah, I love Wea. She's been on the show a couple times.
One of the coolest people, just and wrote the foreword for my current book, which is The Tables.
Yeah, I saw that and I was like, oh, exciting.
So yeah, the whole publishing journey, it's interesting because self-publishing is a challenge just because there's so much that you have to consider. Like I had to get someone to make the cover for me who happened to be like a really good friend of mine. Mm-hmm. Jeremy De La Rosa, who's now a tattoo artist, but still doing like oil and stuff. But also like one of my only other friends that had like a really strong occult basis. And so I trusted him with it and he did a great job on both of the covers for my self-published stuff. Also had to like find, like edit it myself and then also find another editor to go over it, which also happened to be another really good friend, Lena Koivula. And they were in school for editing and like wanting to get more under their belt. So did it for a good price and did a really great job. So yeah, I guess the journey for self-publishing was more about networking and like figuring all that out. And just really having confidence and faith in your own work. Just being like, no, this is good. This is valuable and it's worth being out in the world. And then making it happen.
Yeah.
And then working with Cross Crow. I mean, it's been absolutely amazing. Cross Crow is so cool. And like the process has been really, really awesome. Everyone I've worked with has been so kind and just really excited about what they do and excited about getting other people's ideas out in the world. And the Malloway brothers have like this beautiful vision for how occult publishing can be. And they've found a team of people that believe in the same way and are just as dedicated. And everyone that works there is so talented. Like, I'm just blown away by the whole process with Cross Crow.
Yeah. Boy, is it easier to have someone do all that heavy lifting for you on the publishing side?
It really is. I love just finishing a manuscript and being like, here you go.
I hope you enjoy it. I think one of the things that people who aren't in publishing would find interesting about self-publishing is how much, you know, writers really aren't necessarily don't come equipped to do all of the things that are required to get a book out in the world. And like you said, it becomes a group project, hopefully with people you know and trust, but sometimes you have to take a leap and find an editor you don't know or something. And I think it's, you know, it's an adventure in its own right, but not one to be taken lightly, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, you can just push publish on Amazon or wherever you publish, but yeah, that's not going to best represent your work, I think.
No, not at all. Like, if I didn't have Lena helping me, like, both of those first books would have been a convoluted mess, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's, well, you know, as a writer, it's just almost impossible. I mean, I'm sure someone will pipe up and say, no, I'm great at it, but it's almost impossible to edit your own work because you see things you thought you were in there that you put in there already that someone else may not get. You know, your brain just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. And like, my brain has already seen that mistake 500 times and hasn't seen it yet. So
yeah,
probably not gonna.
And I mean, you know, like, I'm sure somewhere in the world there's a clean final manuscript that has no typos and no mistakes and no anything in it. I've yet to find one, but I'm sure they exist. But yeah, like, you know, in regular publishing, 10 people can look at that and it can still make it through to the final print. So
yeah, I noticed a couple of things in even the Cross Crow book where there was like just like a couple of really minor mistakes, but mm-hmm. I reread it like 3 times and my editor reread it like 3 times and then it went through layouts and, mm-hmm. yeah. and everybody missed those minor little things. And
yeah.
Just happens.
Yeah. I mean, it's a ton of moving parts. So folks who might go looking for your self-published books, because I did after I read your book, will find that On Needles and Pins is not currently available.
Yeah.
But for good reason.
For good reason, Cross Crow picked that one up as well. And so that should be coming out in their fall 2025 catalog.
Awesome. I can't wait.
Yeah. It should be available for like the spooky season, I'm hoping.
Nice. Yeah. It's so funny too. Like, you think about like book publishing and Cross Crow, I know, and lots of other publishers do like a spring and a fall group. And like the fall one year, it's like, oh, I want to be in the spooky season release. But, you know, spring can have its own spookiness.
Oh, totally. So,
it's a liminal time, too.
It's a liminal time. There's a lot of lore about, you know, the springtime and fairies and being stolen. And
yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot. Yeah. There's a lot of reason to be scared all year long. So.
Like, just be aware. So I want to talk about your book that will have been out for a little bit when people finally hear this, but The Tameless Path deals with a subject near and dear to my heart, invasive plants. And oh, cool. So what, I guess, took you down the Tameless Path to write this book?
So what took me down the Tameless Path? Honestly, so I've told this story a few times, but I think it's like, it is how I started. My first herbal mentor, her name is Bernadette. She's a curandera here in Albuquerque. And I met her when I was going through massage school and we just became really close. And so I started learning with her on my own. And one of the first things she ever taught me was that the medicine you need grows near to you. Mm-hmm. Like she said, open your front door and the medicine you need will be right there. And so I did. And the plant that was growing extremely prolifically all around my house was London Rocket, which is an invasive kind of mustard. And I started doing research into it and eating it and just kind of playing around with it, making tinctures and oxymels and I built a pretty good relationship with that plant and then got really interested in all the plants growing around it, which also turned out to be invasive weeds. And from there, I just started learning about these things that we call invasive and trying to figure out what it means when you call a thing invasive. One of the reviewers that didn't like the book as much is like, you conflate like weeds and invasives and non-natives and like, you know, all of these other labels. And I was like, yeah, I do, because they're just labels to like to put on a plant that we don't want there, that we're shifting the blame to. So it doesn't really matter to me whether you're calling it invasive or a weed or a non-native or whatever. Really, it's just blame shifting.
Right.
Because, you know, we've entered these ecosystems. It's really because of human activity that the idea of invasion has even become like a major part of like our zeitgeist today, because we're seeing these plants, like we're seeing natives dying off. We're seeing these non-natives taking their place. And then we're like, oh, we have a problem with invasive species. But really, it's because of our activity. Like, we're the ones that screwed it up.
Yeah.
And now we are shifting the blame to these invasives of various sorts. You know, and then doing these giant pushes to just eradicate them, pull them out, and destroy these enormous swaths of land to get rid of, like, invasive plants. And I don't know, like, the whole thing just drives me insane.
Yeah.
Largely because part of like the major part of a definition of an invasive plant is that it affects the economy. It affects someone's ability to make a profit off of the land. And that, as an animist, really bothers me.
Yeah. One of the things I was thinking about when I was reading your book, so I'm in the Bay Area and we have a couple like local podcasts, and one of them, like, people just write in and ask questions and they answer it, called Bay Curious, if anybody's curious. And they were talking about the ice plant, which is all over the coast here, like all the way down the California coast. And it was brought in to stop dune erosion and to stop dunes from going into fields specifically to damage, you know, cash crops. And so now they've realized that it chokes everything else out because it's so, it grows so densely and, you know, all of these things. But one of the things it does is it changes the pH of the soil and the natives can't grow there. So they've kind of embraced it for doing its job, keeping, you know, coastal erosion at bay, and just try to keep it out of areas where it isn't yet.
Yeah.
And I was like, that to me makes way more sense than, like you said, just going in and ripping out these miles of ice plant and leaving these fragile dunes unprotected when there's, you know, that doesn't make sense either at this point.
No, it really doesn't. And like in the book, I do, like, I make clear, like, I'm not saying like let the invasives take over or like do whatever the hell they want to do. Let them do their job in the places that they need to do their job, which is largely like soil remediation and refertilizing of soil and stopping erosion and cleaning water. Like, a lot of invasive plants are doing like really good work and actually helping the land. But also, like, they do have a tendency of being super opportunistic and taking advantage. And so just like with people who are a little more opportunistic than we'd like, we just need to say, like, no, this is not where you need to be. This is not the job you're doing. And then, like, learn how to harvest and manage them. Like, one of the plants that I think is interesting is kudzu, because people, you know, people hate kudzu. Because it does,
I grew up in East Tennessee. I am very familiar with kudzu. Yes.
And it does. It takes up huge, huge swaths of land. And I was just talking with someone who was noticing kudzu in their neighborhood and how, like, they live in a part of the city that is, like, lower on the socioeconomic scale. And so there are a lot of, like, people living in more rundown houses, like, homes, because of course the city isn't giving money to the people that actually need it. But just another problem, you know. But the kudzu, they were saying, is like growing in people's yards and then like ripping their doors down and stuff. And like, that is a major problem. And kudzu does need to be very rigorously managed.
Mm-hmm.
But a book that I use pretty heavily, as research for mine, is Beyond the War on Invasive Plants, mm-hmm. or Beyond the War on Invasive Species by Dow Orion.
Mm-hmm.
And in her book, she puts forward this whole like economy based entirely on kudzu.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you can make fuel with it, you can make food with it, you can make paper with it, you like you can make like all kinds of stuff. You can make baked goods with it. Like, mm-hmm. it's,
yeah,
it's really
completely
amazing.
Edible. Yeah. Absolutely. It's good forage for animals. Yeah.
Yeah. The whole thing is absolutely useful. And it makes delicious purple honey. And the root is great for people who are dealing with alcohol addictions. And like, there's just so much that you could do with that. But we've been sold this story, not only about kudzu, but a lot of invasives, that they are just bad. And they're not valuable in any way. And like, they're not worth your time. Like, we have to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so people don't even think about it. Also, like, there's a whole other story about how our ancestors in various ways were taken away from growing their own food. And then like the only food that's like worth eating is at the grocery store. And like, mm-hmm. just another way for a small group of people to monopolize on, you know, something essential to life.
Mm-hmm.
And so like people started to distrust the food that you can just get outside on the ground.
Yeah.
Like I deal with it all the time in my classes where people are like, you just put that in your mouth. I'm like, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
That's what we're here to learn. What you can put in your mouth.
Yeah.
And so it's just like, we're dealing with so much like manipulative propaganda, like propagandizing, that's meant to make a very small fraction of people a very large amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we're really having to work through like the trauma of that and figure out how to move forward from there and reclaim a lot of our sovereignty. And I think that working with invasive plants is one of the most accessible ways of doing that.
Yeah. I think a lot about, like I said, you know, growing up in East Tennessee, and my mom's family was very Appalachian. And, you know, we ate a lot of poke salad when I was a kid. And, you know, if you tell people that now, they're like, oh my God, it's poison and you'll die. And I was like, not if you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, not if you know what you're doing. If your great grandmother taught your grandmother and your grandmother taught your mom, you're not going to die at dinner.
Right.
So, but, yeah, like, and it's a food I miss,
mm-hmm.
you know, as an adult, like, I don't have access to it where I am. And, you know, I think about my mom making poke salad, and she would make this thing kind of like fried okra with the stems.
Oh, yeah.
That was delicious, you know, and like those kind of foods that we lose as we urbanize and all of those kind of things, and just how it, you know, kind of impoverishes our diet in a way too.
Oh, it really does. Yeah. And then, like, there's a whole history of racism and classism behind the reasons that now people distrust the land and the food that grows on it. Like, I don't know. Like, the whole thing is just gross.
Yeah.
Just trying to return to a more like land-based diet, plus the idea that you're eating the food that grows on the land that you're living on, I think is really essential. Because like, as an animist, as a magical practitioner, I recognize that my energy, like the parts that make up my physical body, parts of my astral body, like all of this stuff, are also mixed up with the land.
Mm-hmm.
Like the trees that I take care of, the like parts of my garden, the wild spaces I enter, even the urban areas like parks and just driving around, like everything that I am is a part of the land that I'm on. And so bioregionally, like I want to make a connection to those plants that I have a stronger connection, not only to the land, but to myself. And I think that though, like, that's also a nuance that is kind of lost if you don't engage with the land in this way and like really, really listen.
Yeah.
And eat, you know, the food that is there for you.
Yeah.
Exactly. I was actually just talking to someone about poke salad, and they were like, well, poke salad isn't something you would choose to eat. It's a poverty food. And I was
delicious.
Oh, yeah, right. It was like, okay, well, I know a lot of people who would disagree, but yeah. You do you, girl. It's fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like, there are so many things that you could make a salad out of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, why choose poke? Because people like the taste of poke. And, like, it's something that you can trust if you know what you're doing.
Exactly. And just, like, you know, like, spring onion, you know, the wild spring onions. And, I mean, there's just a lot of things, you know, like, and blackberries. I mean, you know, like, how can someone say that that's a poverty food? They're delicious and they're amazing. And if you buy it at the fancy grocery store, it's going to cost you an arm and a leg.
Right. Like, you can buy a little can of it or a little plastic box of it for $6.
Yeah.
Or you can go out to the metro.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Get it for free. Well, and just, you know, I think as we realize that climate change is going to, has already started to interrupt supply chains and change how food sheds work and all of that, like, these are the things that I think will save us.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't quite embraced that yet.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think I even say that in the book, like, invasives are here to save our lives.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and even like, though Japanese knotweed is horribly aggressive, like you said in the book, can just, like, you know, destroy a foundation of a house. It also tastes really good.
Yeah.
Go eat it.
Go eat it. Use it in your magic. Make something with it. Like, make a relationship with it in such a way that you're learning how to manage its more destructive potential.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like anything else.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, moving from Tennessee to California, like, one of the trees that gets planted where I am as a street tree, which I find fascinating, are magnolias. Like the big, you know, white flowered ancient magnolia, but they cut all the branches off like halfway up the tree to make it like a street tree, which not how magnolias grow.
Yeah.
And it's so funny to meet it here and know that it doesn't really belong in California, and it's not at its best in California. But when we were looking for a place to rent, there's a magnolia in the yard, and I was like, this is the place.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't appreciate what they've done to it, poor magnolia tree, but it's still trying to grow. It's still trying to live in this place. It doesn't belong. So.
And you had, like, a relationship with it from where you came from. And, like, I think that's also really important. And, like, with the idea of poke salad, like, that's something that a lot of people did grow up with. And like, it's a part of an ancestral heritage, and it's a connection to, like, the spirits of the past. And like, if that's something that, like, nourishes you and empowers you, like, that's fucking cool. And, like, I'm not going to denigrate you eating poke, especially because poke is actually pretty okay.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm
not going to be weird about it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, at the Salem Witch Fest, I was talking to one of the other presenters, Professor Porterfield, about using poppets for a particular working. And he was like, at first, he was like, well, maybe not. Like, I don't see where that would really work. And then he, like, started talking about it, working through it. He was like, but if your ancestry, like, if you're, like, one of the lines of ancestry that really used poppets, like, yeah, sure, whatever, do it. Like, pop it, girl, pop off, you know? And I was like, okay, cool. So, like, there are also these really interesting aspects of ancestral lineage and ancestral being, where one thing, like, we can't denigrate one thing for one person, especially if, like, in an ancestral way, like, it's actually a really powerful part of who they are, just because we think it's, like, a quote unquote poverty food, or like, nobody's doing that on purpose. Yeah, they are, because it's really cool and part of who they are.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, like, when people talk about, and I've even seen this, like, trend recently on social media about what is your like if you grew up poor, like what's your poverty meal that you still have as comfort food? And I was like, you know, it was interesting because some of the comments were like, I don't like to talk. I'm not going to tell people that. Like, I'm not going to. And I'm like, but this is something that's foundational to who you are as a person, because this is how your family fed themselves when they didn't have access to other things. And if you still find comfort in that, then that means that they did their, your parents did their job of keeping you safe and fed.
Yeah.
You know, so like, just that we kind of.
It irritates me too.
Yeah.
I'm like, sure, like you can call it a poverty food, but like you're saying, like it's still a part of someone like taking care of you, and it's a passed down, like especially in the case of Poke, it's a passed down lineage of knowledge. Like there's a lot of power and connectivity there. And like, you know, like in the idea of like poverty food, there is, like, I have a friend who would eat, like, just bologna and mayo. And it was, like, bologna and mayo fried up in a pan. And now, like, it was something that her mother would make for her when she was, like, not feeling well or when she was really sad or, like, she stayed home from school because, like, the bullying was too hard or, like, you know, that kind of shit. And, now every time she's feeling that way, she can just kind of like fry up a little bit of bologna, and it like it actually does help to enliven and like revivify her and her resolve. And I don't know, I think that's a really cool thing. And just the fact that so many of the plants that now we consider invasive were like part of our ancestors' like pretty staple food base. Like I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind. And like, why are they invasive now?
Yeah. And I think one of the things you point out in the book that I really like sat with when I read it was we don't talk about the fact that most of the food crops that we eat in the United States are technically not native invasive plants. We just don't call them that because they grow in a field on purpose.
Yeah. And somebody's making a shit ton of money off of them. Like, but if you think about not totally like soybeans, like huge, huge tracts of land.
Soybean.
And it's like part of the definition of invasive is that it's a non-native, that it takes up a large amount of land and eats away resources that natives could use. And like, what else is a gigantic acres and acres and acres like field of soybeans?
Yeah.
Like what the hell else is that? You're just making money off of it.
Yeah.
Like that's the only difference. Yeah. Totally. And so when you're looking at, like, if you're looking at the difference between a non-native and a native, like, what really, like, how are we defining those things? Because some of the things that we define as non-native have been here for, like, hundreds of years and have fully naturalized. And so, like, is that still a non-native just because it hasn't been here for thousands of years? And then also in the book, or like, it didn't evolve here, because a lot of things didn't evolve here. and like still are good actors within their ecosystem and are still like providing shelter and food and drawing water through the soil and like doing all of the things that we would consider good in an ecosystem. Like they may not have evolved here, but they've still naturalized in a way that they're being good actors. And then even in the case of invasives, like in the book, I mentioned that they are first stage successional plants in a lot of cases, which are there to remediate soils and make it possible for other plants to grow there in the future. But part of the problem with these cycles of invasive intrusions is that we mess up that cycle again and again and again. And so like they go in and they start like remediating the soil But then human activity interrupts it. Like there's people running all across that area, or somebody comes and digs it up, but then decides not to, and then it's just disturbed soil again. Or like not to build a house, or like whatever they were going to do on that land. There is pollution. There is just like this constant rumble and dissonance in the air, like all around these places. And so this soil can't reach a place where it could allow other plants to grow. And so we see these cyclical intrusions of invasives. But again, like saying that that invasive plant is the problem, or like making an entire science around it that says that this needs to be eradicated for A, B, and C reason, is just blame shifting, because really it's us. Yeah. We're the problem.
We're the problem.
Raise your hand. We're the problem.
Yeah.
And it's just not fair. Mm-hmm. It's not fair to these plants that are really just, and like various invasive animals too. Like I see all of these stories about invasive species when it comes to animals, and really they're just following like warming water patterns, like into areas where they haven't been. And then they mm-hmm. are taking advantage of a new food source that is like devastating an ecosystem. But why is the warmth of the water changing? Why is there a different chemical gradient? Like,
yeah,
why are they doing that?
It's how did they get transported there?
How the hell did they get there in the first place? Great question.
Yeah.
You know, then we're just like, well, this is a very problematic species, and this is a new this is a new chemical weapon against them that we've just developed.
That always
only
goes well.
$400 a gallon, but you need it.
Well, and I always think about like with animal species, especially when you think about like, well, let's induce this thing to deal with this other thing,
and then that thing becomes invasive. It's like, just, and they're like, oh no, now we have a moth problem.
Like, oops. I mean, that's okay. How pets you got here, right? Was because soil erosion or something.
Right.
Planted for soil erosion.
Another story that I like is like the American thrush, mm-hmm. because of development along riparian areas and along coastlines, the American thrush has become like mostly extinct, like it's on the brink of extinction, mm-hmm. Because so much of its native habitat has been destroyed, not because of invasives, but because of human beings.
Right.
And now one of the invasive plants that grows very well in riparian areas are various species of tamarisk. And now the American thrush finds that, like, we're finding that it is making its habitat in the tamarisk. And so now there's this dilemma, because there's an invasive species invading these riparian areas, but it's actually allowing a nearly extinct native species to survive.
Yeah.
And if you take out the tamarisk, that bird will die. And so it's, you know, now, like, that indicates to me, at least, that invasives are capable, and actually more often than not, good actors within their ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And they're doing something important.
Yeah.
And the ecosystem will find a way if we stop being dicks about it. Like, not that yeah. put too fine a point on it, you know?
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, I think sometimes you got to use technical language, right?
Right. I hope this doesn't get you an NC-17 rating or whatever.
No, I when I started the podcast, I went ahead and just did an explicit, because I was like, we're talking about witchcraft. Somebody's going to say it's explicit. So I just went with it.
It's okay.
Yeah. So when it, you know, I guess kind of to circle back around to writing and that, like when you, one of the things I did appreciate about the book, and we talked about this a little bit, we were talking about footnotes, is that you do source your information, and you have this in-depth bibliography that just added like 10 books to my to-be-read pile. but so, I mean, for you, like where do you go for information? Because I feel like there is a bit of a dearth, especially in this area when we're talking about invasive, she does scare quotes that listeners can't see,
totally.
Plants. So, you know, where do you go for information other than like obviously your personal gnosis and working with the plants?
when I am looking, so especially for this book, I really just Googled like invasive species and looked at the books that popped up, which there weren't many. Mm-hmm. And then looked into like, because I had a particular thing I wanted to talk about with these invasives, which is that they're not the enemy. Mm-hmm. And that we should be making friends with them and seeing them as like a part of our family. Like they are kin to us. So how mm-hmm. do we treat them like that? And so I looked at the books that were available and then looked to see like who was coming at it from a conservation standpoint and who was coming at it from a permaculture standpoint. Mm-hmm. Because conservation theory is more along the lines of get rid of it. Let's conserve like what historically has been here by A, destroying landscapes and then renativing them, which is like, what? Blowing my mind here. And then permaculture has always been more like, it's here for a reason. Like, what's the reason? I want to know more about that and listen to that. And so I did look for more permaculture-based books. And the two that really like stood out to me were Beyond the War on Invasive Species and The New Wild. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I looked at their bibliographies. Like if someone has a meaty bibliography, definitely look through it because it's like, if you're interested in that topic, they have that meaty bibliography because mm-hmm. they're also interested in that topic and they're going to have a lot of good sources.
Yeah.
And so I went through a lot of their sources and a lot of the articles that they were referencing, I went and found and read through myself. And JSTOR is a great place for that mm-hmm. because even if you're working outside of a university, if you have a Google account, I'm pretty sure it's just Google. Maybe there's others. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But you can get like 100 articles per month for free. Mm-hmm. And that's really cool. Yeah. And so I was just downloading article after article. Yeah. Like, and just really reading through it. Mm-hmm. But I think when it comes to finding resources, like look to the people that you respect and then look to the people that they respect and then find that lineage and just follow it. Follow those threads. And you'll find so much information.
Yeah. But just, I mean, like you said, JSTOR, and I think about like academia.edu, and there's like so many good places to get information. Internet Archive. Oh, Internet Archive. Bless them. I know they get a lot of hot water for stuff, but I don't think I could do the research I'm doing without the benefit of them having access to books that haven't been in print for, 100 years.
For so long.
Yeah.
And I found so many like out of print, super rare books that have been mm-hmm. fully scanned. Mm-hmm. And like I was reading through one for my recent talk in Salem on exorcism. And it was a older book about exorcism. And the initial warning was like, book has been soaked, book is severely damaged. But on Internet Archive, they had like the scan had been mm-hmm. Remastered so you could read the whole book.
Yeah.
And it was just so awesome. Also, I'm a DM in D&D and they have so many old D&D books that you can't get anymore.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
The lore that is now in D&D is built on all that older stuff. And mm-hmm. with Internet Archive, I can go and read it.
Yeah.
And the same thing for witchcraft. Like there are so many ideas that I want to know more about. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to find the source, and Internet Archive has been great.
Yeah. I've been on this like nostalgic kick for like kind of back to the land books from the 70s, kind of like in that Foxfire, that whole kind of, and there's so much of that on Internet Archive. Those books are out of print, but they're still copyright. So you can't just get them, but they have them scanned and you can borrow it from Internet Archive and read it. So.
Right. And like everybody, all the cool girls like libraries.
Amen. Amen. Amen.
Internet Archive is just a really weird, like, it's kind of a library I always wanted as a kid.
Yeah.
Where I could just think of something and poof.
There it is. Well, yeah. No, it's brilliant. And yeah, I am between, you know, like the AI-ification of the internet, I feel like Internet Archive and Wikipedia, which also took a lot of heat initially, are going to be the things that become like, okay, this is actual information and not AI generating garbage.
Totally. And like with Wikipedia, you can also check the sources. Mm-hmm. And like Wikipedia is a really great starting point. I never like footnote or cite Wikipedia, mm-hmm. but Wikipedia is a really great starting place where I can be like, is that a real thing? Did that happen? And then go research it.
And there's a little note.
And then like, and there's then a little note. And then, oh shit, that did happen. Yeah. Wow, thank you, Wikipedia.
Yeah, and a lot of those random things on Wikipedia, you can find on Internet Archive.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's you know, it's a kind of an embarrassment of riches, even though I think there's a lot of people who, you know, unfortunately, at this point we're in right now, want people to have less access to information. We've never had more access.
Yeah. And it's like big and like it's big. It's very big. Mm-hmm. And like you're mentioning with AI, it's a little scary right now. But like, you know, vet your sources, vet the information, make sure that you're seeing it in like multiple places that are verifiable. And, you know,
do not buy an AI mushroom foraging book and feed your family.
Yeah. Because chanterelle is like a hell of a lot like jack-o'-lanterns, you know. Yep.
Yeah.
AI doesn't know the difference. AI can't spore print for you.
No. So no.
Be careful.
Oh, yeah. So on that note, I wanted to give you an opportunity to plug what's coming up for you. Like I said, this will come out in January. So the book will have been out for a while, but what's on your agenda and where can people find more about you?
Oh, you can find more about me mostly on my Instagram, which is at heart_n_vine_apothecary. It is very long. I don't fully understand why, but it's what I chose. And that's really where I advertise. Right now, I don't have anything concrete, but I may have something coming up in January. So this may come out at a very opportune time for all of us.
I like it.
I've just submitted to Genii Viridis, so we'll see what happens there, but something may happen in January. I just haven't heard, like a lot of the conferences now are like we're submitting and we haven't heard back yet, but keep your eyes on my Insta because that's where I advertise for all that stuff. And then I do have a website, heartandvineapothecary.com, which I try to keep up with, but you know.
Cool. And we'll put links for all that in the show notes for folks, especially that long Instagram handle.
Thank you.
Make sure people can find that. But so our last question for everybody, kind of our hook, gimmick, whatever for the podcast, kind of a little game of chance. And as I mentioned, I'm from the South and, you know, we grew up with this admonition to not talk about certain things in polite company. Which are, of course, as a Scorpio, my favorite things to talk about.
Me too. I'm a Capricorn moon, so let's start some stuff.
So I'll roll this lovely little purple D&D die. And you'll, depending on what number I roll, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money.
Oh, shit. Okay.
And if I roll a 6, you get to pick which one you want, and you can pass.
Okay.
Because, you know, I am a Scorpio, but I also don't like rules. So 2, sex.
Oh, shit. All right. Sure.
It's been a while since we've had that one, oddly. So one of the things I was thinking about, and I write new questions for everybody on the show, and sometimes it's difficult to write questions because I'm like, I haven't heard this person talk about this at all. But I was thinking, like, you know, one of the things, especially because, like, love magic is so popular, I think even more popular with people outside of witchcraft than it is with people inside of witchcraft.
Yeah.
That, you know, people just want to know, like, how do I make them love me? Whatever. But to bring that back to kind of an herbal apothecary kind of thing. So herbal aphrodisiacs, are they bunk? Or can plants really help you get frisky?
I will say yes. I think that they can. I think it takes kind of understanding what's going on with your body and like why you may be having trouble getting in the mood. And from there, kind of figuring it out. Like if you're low in T for a masculine person, if you're low in T, your sex drive is just, well, actually, if you're low in T, sex drive is low for everybody. It doesn't matter who you are.
Yeah.
And there are plants that can help, not necessarily raise testosterone. The only phytotestosterones I can even think of are corn and pine pollen. But there are things that can kind of help regulate testosterone and stop its metabolization into dihydrotestosterone. And so you can kind of help manage that and then maybe be more frisky more of the time, which is fun. So like pumpkin seed, saw palmetto, those kinds of things. A more invasive one is tribulus or puncture vine or goat head. That one is, people say that it is aptly named, right? people say that the science is in and out with the testosterone bit on tribulus, but it does seem to be good at promoting the production of testosterone. It's not a testosterone itself, but the promotion of the production is awesome. And then of course, are you too stressed out? Skullcap is great. Mm-hmm. Get in that mood there. And then Damiana is one of the ones that people use as an aphrodisiac all the time. And really that's not going to make you feel horny, but it's going to it's a mood booster.
Yeah.
So it really helps to elevate mood. It helps with the kidneys. It just kind of helps you feel more vital in general.
Yeah.
And so really understanding what's going on and then coming at it from a well thought out, nuanced direction. Mm-hmm. I think that aphrodisiacs really can help. And then things like rose and chocolate. I mean,
it just makes you feel good.
Get horny for chocolate.
It just makes you feel good.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking when you were saying that about are you stressed out? And I mean, there's been all these scare headlines about young people aren't having sex and we don't have enough babies and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, have you looked out the window?
Have you looked around us?
Yeah. Yes, perhaps endocrine disruptors and microplastics and all of that things are bad, but have you just looked at how stressed people are?
Have you looked stressed? Would you find it easy to have copious amounts of sex and babies when the only way that you can live is to have five roommates?
Yeah, really. Is conducive to lots of sex, unless you were having sex with your roommates, I guess.
With your roommate, which is a beautiful.
No shame on this show.
No, that's a beautiful way to live. I feel like most people are roommating because that's the only way to survive. I don't know. It's just wild. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm interested. I like that I got the sex question because a lot of what I've been my recent work is more in the realm of the erotic and desire and thinking of the erotic as a primordial force and dealing with Eros as a primordial god. Which a lot of my work coming up is going to be about. So if you're interested in sex and desire and its intersection with creation and liminality.
Yeah.
Keep your eyes open.
Watch the space.
Watch the Also, if you like Lacan and Freud, keep your eyes open.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Camden, thank you so much. This has been a delight. And I really enjoyed talking to you. I really enjoyed the book. I can't wait to get my hands on a copy of On Pins and Needles when it comes out next year. When we're talking, it'll be this year, which is even better.
I'll come back on and we can talk about that too.
That sounds great. Sounds excellent. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time and wisdom. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Victoria. This was really, really fun. Thank you.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shanekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram or Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. And thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.